This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. About 3 years ago, FBI agent Colleen Raleigh sent a memo to her boss, FBI Director Robert Mueller, which sparked controversy around the country. Ms. Raleigh criticized the agency for ignoring crucial information sent from her Minneapolis field office. Specifically, the memo charged that headquarters had not fully looked into her office's request to investigate Zacharias Moussaoui, the man who is now believed to be the 20th hijacker on September 11th. A few months later, Colleen Raleigh was the star witness before the Senate Judiciary Committee looking into intelligence failures before the attacks on New York and Washington. She testified that the culture at the FBI was overly bureaucratic and risk-averse, which then led to a breakdown in communication between her office and her Washington headquarters. At the end of last year, Colleen Raleigh retired from the FBI after 24 years. She'll join us in a few minutes. If you have questions for Colleen Raleigh about changes at the FBI, the intelligence community, how far we have to go in preserving our civil liberties, or perhaps are they eroding in the name of national security, give us a call at 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or email address totn@npr.org. We turn now our conversation to the recently retired FBI agent Colleen Raleigh. Ms. Raleigh joins us from the studios in Minnesota, Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul. She's the FBI agent from the Minneapolis field office who sent a memo to FBI Director Robert Mueller, in 2002, complaining that the Bureau mishandled warning signs before the September 11th attack. She retired in December, and she joins us now. Colleen, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
First, I want to get your reaction today to the announcement that John Negroponte will be the first director of national intelligence, this presumably an office that will coordinate the information, part of the problem that you said was to blame for the breakdown before September 11th. Do you think this is going to help?
Well, actually, no, and I don't think I'm alone. I think many intelligence officials and even people in law enforcement did not see the need for a national intelligence director, being that we already had a director of central intelligence. And they see this, at the very least, just as a name change, and at worst, a possible politicalization of the whole intelligence gathering process.
Well, the other side of that is you actually potentially add another layer of gathering and sifting to the process. Do you see that as a potential threat?
Exactly. When I testified to the Judiciary Committee, I said that the bureaucracy was like the plant in the Little Shop of Horrors that constantly says, feed me, feed me, and that we somehow had to find a way to trim the bureaucracy and decentralize decision making. So this actually flies in the exact opposite direction.
Well, you stayed at the FBI for 2.5 years after you sent your memo to the director. Have you seen any changes, or did you see any changes over that period of time?
Yes, there were tremendous changes internally in the FBI. It transformed itself from an essentially a criminal investigative agency more to something in the mode of a domestic CIA in terms of intelligence collection, analysis, and dissemination. And, of course, with the goal being to prevent future acts of terrorism, you have to become much more proactive, and that's what the FBI has done.
One of the complaints or the criticisms that emerged through the 9/11, the hearing process, was that the FBI is made up essentially of lawyers, and they're trying to build a case. And what you do to build a case is far different from what you do to prevent a crime. And so, and I wonder if that has changed, if the fundamental mission of the FBI has changed enough to allow it to be more proactive.
Well, of course, not only the FBI, but the public at large and all of the other institutions were overly complacent during the summer of 2001. And that has changed. The FBI and other intelligence agencies are very proactive these days. They have a policy of no tip, and essentially that means no call into the FBI will go uncovered. And so that means, to the extent that you talk about intelligence collection, really massive intelligence collection.
Let's go to the phones now. We have John Paul on the line from Tucson. John Paul, you have a question?
Yes. I was wondering what sort of risks Agent Raleigh would have proposed for the FBI, because I would think that some people who are arguing for the, they wouldn't call it the violation of civil liberties, but are taking risks by gathering that information about people. Yes, might violate civil liberties, but that's a risk that the FBI needs to take.
All right. So you're suggesting that that the risk averse works two ways, that in some ways we ought to risk perhaps the consequences
how
of...
I'm wondering risk adverse,
yeah.
Considering that's how other people might argue risk adverse.
Colleen?
Well, the caller makes a good point, and when I testified, when I said the word risk averse, I was actually meaning, my meaning was much more in line with the caller's. Certain officials, as you go up the ranks of the bureaucracy, it becomes easier and easier to do nothing, and especially if the consequences of doing nothing are safer. Now, that is no longer the case, of course, because after the 9/11 Commission and the Joint Intelligence Committee, everyone is quite aware that the consequences of doing nothing can be equally fraught with disaster and whatever. So the risk averse really cuts in both directions. The caller is exactly right. And security and liberty are completely intertwined. You can't have one without the other.
We are talking today to Colleen Rowley. She's the FBI agent from the Minneapolis field office who sent a memo to FBI Director Robert Mueller in 2002 that complained the Bureau mishandled the warning signs before September 11th. She has since retired and is warning now about the erosion of civil liberties. When we come back after this short break, we will continue that conversation. And your phone calls, 1-800-989-TALK. You can send us an email at totn@npr.org. I'm Frank Stachow. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Frank Stachow in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan, talking with Colleen Rowley, the FBI agent who wrote a letter to her boss, Robert Mueller, criticizing the agency for lapses in its pre-September 11th counterintelligence and counterterrorism efforts. And you're invited to join the discussion. Give us a call at 1-800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or send us an email at totn@npr.org. Colleen, after you sent the memo and testified, you began giving talks around the country about ethics, integrity, and civil liberties. Who are you talking to? What are you saying?
Well, I've talked to various professional groups. I guess the most unusual are the nuclear plant safety officials, NASA legal officials, different lawyer groups, law schools, everyone from civic church groups, etc. I think ethics is very important, and unfortunately, in the civil liberties and war on terrorism, it's appalling the lack of public appreciation and understanding of what's going on.
Well, what is going on, do you think?
Well, what's going on is that when these two dual goals are promised, to protect civil liberties and also to detect and thwart terrorism, it always elicits audience applause. But then no one asks the hard questions following that, is exactly how is this happening? And while officials cannot really disclose, obviously, specific facts of cases, they could do a much better job in telling the public what the authorities are and how they're being used, and hopefully properly used as they were intended. That's where the public really does not, when I even say the word FISA, which means Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, even to law groups, no one understands what I'm even talking about.
Well, do you think, before we get into that, do you think that the Patriot Act, for instance, was necessary?
Well, the Patriot Act is the source of much misinformation as well. It's 160 different provisions of law. And so to the extent that people often say I'm for it or I'm against it, that really doesn't make much sense. And I've seen in all kinds of statements so many errors about the Patriot Act, which really goes to show that the public doesn't know what they're talking about.
Let's go to the phones now. Richard is on the line from Winston-Salem. Hello, Richard.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes. Actually, that indeed was my question. And I actually have read the whole Patriot Act. My question would be, do you think it would have prevented the incidents of September 11th had we had that?
The most important change in the Patriot Act that was wrought by the Patriot Act is funny because it's a one-word change. And it brought down what we called the FISA wall, which what prevented intelligence sharing between intelligence and law enforcement. That particular law, and actually it turns out a misinterpretation of the laws and the procedures, was behind not connecting probably the two most significant dots The search for the hijackers who came in San Diego that were already on a terrorist list, as well as the Minnesota case. It was the largest thing behind the inaction in those cases. So, yes, to that extent, the FISA wall down made a huge difference.
Thank you for your call, Richard. Well, I want to probe a little farther because you talked about the misinterpretation of the rule. The rule said that you can't exchange information about cases that are open, so that agencies couldn't give information about open cases. And the thought was, if you could have told me what you were investigating over here at the CIA, we could have told you what we knew, connect the dots, stop the attack. That was the thought. But talk about this misinterpretation, because as it turned out, and what the 9/11 Commission found was that wall was never there. It was perceived to be there. Am I right?
Yeah. Over in the 1990s, and actually the behind the FISA wall, there is a good purpose. The purpose was to prevent the abuse of this secret FISA court authority, which is quite significant. And again, that's where some civil liberties issues are involved. So in order to try to prevent that abuse, they came up with procedures. And over time, over maybe a 6-7 year period of time, this wall grew higher and higher, to the point where when the FISA Court of Appeal had to really look at it after the Patriot Act was passed, they essentially said that the wall, you know, the whole issue was not even correctly analyzed. Right now, what people don't understand is when they talk about the sunsetting of the Patriot Act, this one provision, which is perhaps the most significant provision change in the Patriot Act, probably can't sunset. Because now it is a court has judicially decided that it was due to a misinterpretation, and it's not really resting solely upon the statute, which is the Patriot Act.
So go back to the original question. If the Patriot Act had been in effect and if FISA had been properly understood, would that have made any difference? Would the Patriot Act have made things any better?
Well, what of course I even said from the start was that no one will ever know if 9/11 could have actually been prevented. And it's kind of misleading to even talk about in terms of prevention as if you prevent it one day and then you prevent it for all time. But there are several possible ways and theories that certainly the attacks on that day could have been minimized. And perhaps if the cockpit doors had been, if somebody had connected these dots, and actually the former director of the CIA had a lot of the information. For instance, that director Tenet knew of the Minnesota case. So if he had connected it all and a stronger warning had gone to the FAA and then the FAA had followed up on it and bolted the cockpit doors, that, in essence, probably would have been very effective in stopping the attacks.
Let's go to Sean, who's on the line in Las Vegas. Hello, Sean. Sean, are you there?
Yes.
You have a question for us?
Well, actually, I have a comment and then a question. My first comment is the Patriot Act. It sort of it frustrates the heck out of me that we're taking all these extreme steps and trampling on civil rights to in the name of protecting the nation. But as far as the FISA wall goes, and you're you sound like you don't like the idea of an intelligence director, but if we have a central intelligence director, wouldn't that sort of bring all these independent agencies together so that one man can look at them all independently and connect the dots?
Yes, perhaps connect the dots, but actually also can serve to minimize or gloss over differences in opinion amongst the 15 intelligence agencies. Prior to the invasion of Iraq, one intelligence agency in the State Department actually got it right on many of the points about the weapons of mass destruction. And that type of thing, there's a danger that that correct, even though they were in the minority, that that correct opinion could be minimized by this kind of politicalization of a national intelligence director.
Right. Well, how would you propose to solve the issue of connecting the dots then?
Well, I think in most cases, the persons who actually thwart terrorism, and if you want, I can name at least half a dozen examples without thinking at all. The customs woman inspector who caught the terrorists coming down from Canada during the millennium. We had a New Jersey trooper who caught a Red Brigade guy on his way to bomb New York in the 1980s. Our Minnesota agents who, in essence, came up with the dot. You will be hard-pressed to find a cabinet-level official or any director who single-handedly stops an act of terrorism. What they can do is streamline and make the people on the bottom who are actually on the front lines able to do their jobs.
Sean, thank you very much for your call. Colleen, I wonder what you think of Portugas' statement yesterday that it's not a matter of whether but when the next terrorist attack will come, and it will be biological, it will be chemical, maybe it'll be nuclear, and it will be Al-Qaeda behind it.
Well, yes, I've been saying the same thing all along. And in fact, it's kind of, someone asked, is it bittersweet now to hear these things, being that I actually warned that the invasion of Iraq would actually heighten the terrorism threat in March of 2003, and was literally criticized, you know, terribly for making that kind of a statement. And so yesterday, many of the officials, Portugas and Director of Defense Intelligence Agency folks, were all saying that same thing, that and because of the threat growing, it's kind of like playing a goalie, and you can do a very good job of blocking some goals, but if they keep coming at you and the threat gets worse, unfortunately, it probably is only a question of time until there is another successful attack.
Let's go to Needham, Massachusetts. David's on the line. Hello, David.
Yeah. Hello. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay, I can barely hear you. I have a question on my profession has been information systems. So I watch the ongoing unrolling of this trilogy system fiasco. And I remember an earlier statement by Ms. Rowley that she sent a memo, and there are 18 layers of management that the information has to pass through. So my fundamental question is, can the FBI, which is clearly a pencil and paper and manila file folder organization, move from the 1950s into the 21st century?
And we should, just before you answer that, we'll talk about Trilogy is actually the FBI computer system. Is that
yes.
right? Yeah.
Okay. Any background you can offer is.
Sure. Colleen?
Yeah, both Director Mueller and I testified to the judiciary about the lack of ability to kind of data mine our own, even our own records that contributed to the lapses pre-9/11. And while that virtual case file system has not materialized and unfortunately has cost taxpayers a lot of money, there have been ways internally in other computer systems set up to kind of compensate for that. In fact, it also constitutes one of the potential dangers to civil liberties because of the data mining of private companies, databases that is going on. One of the first things you would do with a tip, of course, is to see what information already exists. And the amount of collection is quite surprising that's going on in individuals in this country. And law enforcement has contracts with those companies that provide that type of information. So, again, with civil liberties intertwined with security, these are very complicated questions and really justify the need for a Civil Liberties Oversight Board.
David, thank you very much for your call. You, in fact, are talking about the Civil Liberty Oversight Board. It was created last year, and you're also slated to be, or there are those who are recommending that you become, and you would like to become a member of that board. Is that right?
Yeah, I don't think I'm slated to be right now. I think that's still a very long shot. What I am hoping is that people with the proper backgrounds in constitutional law and privacy law, and there are many people that have served in positions, even in government agencies as privacy officers, that would have that kind of academic background. But we need to have five good panel members to serve as objective oversight and consultative role, and even an educational role right now in the with the public in what hopefully will be a long, sustained, judicious effort.
Well, how would it work? Forgive me for interrupting, but give me a sense of how the oversight board would work.
You know, it's not spelled out very well in the law. The Intelligence Reform Act did not really say how this would work. They're supposed to have access, and that's the key thing, because without any access, of course, this would become nothing but a token gesture and lip service. Say we have a Civil Liberties Board, but they really can't see anything and they don't know what's going on. So they definitely have to have access to the various government initiatives. In the last 3 years, many initiatives have gone in the right direction, but we've had a couple, obviously. The post-9/11 Roundup, the torture memos. We've had things that have gone too far. And with a board that could review these things in a proactive way, in the same way that law enforcement and intelligence agencies are trying to stop terrorism, they could detect issues and problems before they become bigger and bigger behind closed doors. So the oversight role and furnishing guidelines, and then you also have the idea of new legislation coming up on the horizon. So if you had some experts there, they would be in a great position to be, you know, consulted as a sounding board. And then the third role, I think, is, as I said, there's an amazing amount of lack of appreciation and understanding by the public. So in terms of just pure education, in order to get public cooperation for these initiatives, I think they could fill that position too.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Frank Stachow. My guest is Colleen Raleigh. She's the FBI agent from the Minneapolis field office who sent a memo to FBI Director Robert Mueller in 2002, complaining of the Bureau's mishandling of warning signs before 9/11. She is currently retired and my guest today. You can give us a call at 800-989-8255 or send us an email at totn@npr.org. As Paul has done from Wilmington, he says, as a whistleblower, can you tell us any disparity between the stated and actual policy toward whistleblowers in the FBI?
Well, that's a good question. Yeah, there is a disparity. There actually is no whistleblower protection by statute that protects anyone in the FBI, the CIA, or any of the other intelligence agencies. We have a version or a light version by regulation that essentially says that out of the goodness of their hearts, they're supposed to try to protect whistleblowers. But I met a couple of months ago, I just met an agent who had served 16 years in the FBI and had resigned out of desperation or, you know, frustration in that his concerns were not making it their way through the pipelines. So, yeah, more has to be done. And it's ironic also that after Enron and WorldCom's collapse, the Sarbanes-Oxley Act passed, which did give great protection to corporate whistleblowers. So in cases of life savings, threats to life savings, we have that kind of protection. But in cases of national security, there's no protection for someone who might witness or see an error or mistake that actually could have life and death consequences.
And I guess the FBI has been legendary as a place where one does not oppose one's superior.
Yeah, there have been a number of cases of persons who had valid concerns, even one of the first ones being with our FBI laboratory in the 1990s. The lab agent merely wanted the FBI lab to be accredited, and because that was unwelcome news, he suffered all kinds of retaliation. Over time, the lab did become accredited, so he did serve a good purpose for doing what he did, but he personally had to suffer severe consequences.
Trust his job. Sam is on the line from Salt Lake City. Hi, Sam.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I just had a question with respect to, I wonder if the threat of terrorism has been overstated to gain acceptance of the Patriot Act, and I was
all right, Sam.
What your thoughts on that were.
Great. We'll do it very quickly. Thank you for your call, Sam.
Thank you.
Well, I don't think the threat is overstated. What kind of looks funny are these color alerts, more so even than the Patriot Act. The last orange alert was on from July, I think, to 4 or 5 hours after the president was declared victory in that election. And that really gives an appearance of looking like it's manipulated to get for whatever purpose, because the amount of threat intelligence information in the 4 hours before and the 4 hours after really doesn't change.
I want to talk to you some more about that, so we'll continue this conversation with Colleen Raleigh. And later in the show, we will make another stop on our tour of African-American historical sites. Today, the all-black town of Nicodemus, Kansas. I'm Frank Stachow. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now, though, we're finishing our conversation about civil liberties with former FBI agent Colleen Raleigh. Colleen, before the break, Sam asked a question about whether or not, you know, we're being sort of frightened and what the effect of all these alerts. And you talked about the color alerts and how they have an impact. I go back to Porter Goss yesterday telling us, look, the attack is inevitable. It's going to happen. In the face of that, as you go around the country warning about the impact on civil liberties, I mean, are people comfortable enough to say, yes, we can, we should think about civil liberties, or are we just too afraid to have that conversation?
Well, it's a sad thing. I think a lot of people do have that mindset that they would just prefer not to know how the government is finding the terrorists, and maybe that's why the question isn't asked. There's a lot of trust. And I'm not against trust. I think trust is great. It's necessary. But in this kind of environment, it's also very important for the public to actually appreciate what they are giving up and what they're getting. When someone goes through the security checkpoint to get onto a plane now, we all take our shoes off momentarily. And you know what you're giving up. You're giving up a slight amount of privacy, a little intrusion into your privacy, but you're also getting the measure of safety of checking those shoes. That's how transparent these other things ought to be to the public. Because the public, when they have that plausible deniability, well, we really didn't know this was going on, in long term, that is not going to serve anyone well.
So there you're talking about perhaps the idea of arresting people without benefit of attorney, that sort of thing, say non-citizens arrested as terrorists, go into a different judicial process altogether. And there the American public doesn't know what happens.
Well, a lot of the initiatives, not just arresting, but all of the FISA authority itself, the searches of computers and private residences, etc., that is all cloaked in secrecy. And actually not even the sneak and peek temporary secrecy, perpetual secrecy. There are people are thinking about this now. There are law professors out there that are really trying to figure out, do we need long-term perpetual secrecy for terrorism, just like we did for country-sponsored spying? Or is it something a little closer to a common criminal, in which case we could have something more temporary and still have that accountability that comes with public understanding and knowledge? But right now, that's pie in the sky because we don't have such a reform in place.
Let's go to Sacramento. John is on the line. Hello, John.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah. Am I on?
Yes, sir. You have a question for us?
Yeah. Those of us that have been trying to educate our local leaders about not to be paranoid the way the federal government is really have very little trust, and we have good reason not to trust what the federal administration is doing and all of its secret agencies. I really appreciate what you're trying to do. But do you have any idea how strong the distrust is among those of us concerned for civil liberties?
Thank you, John.
Yeah, I think 350 communities have voted in a symbolic gesture. Of course, it's not effective because you can't vote not to be a part of the laws of the country. But they've passed resolutions saying that they will not cooperate with the Patriot Act. And so that's exactly what I'm talking about in terms of how ultimately, this is not an effective approach to say, trust us, we're the government, we'll do it right. And that momentum may build up. It depends, of course, on what happens. The other thing that could happen is if we do suffer another terrorist attack, we will not have the mechanisms in place that would prevent fear from taking hold and doing things like the Japanese internment and the post-9/11 roundup. Some of the worst abuses come from fear. The caller is exactly right. And we need to put some mechanisms in place so we can avoid those worst outcomes.
Does the ability to do things in secret and without the kind of public accountability that we've come to expect in democracy, does that take some of the pressure off law enforcement for just good, solid footwork as police officers?
Yeah, that's funny because it ties my two talks. One's on purely on ethics and ethical decision making, and the other one is on balancing civil liberties. But in the ethical decision making realm, there is something called the transparency test. When you're trying to tell kids how to determine right from wrong, you say, "What if your grandma was looking over your shoulder? What if everyone knew?" And usually, the person then will be able to make the right decision. Well, what is the absolute opposite of transparency is perpetual secrecy. And the incentives that even the best people are operating, even the judges, everyone, without anyone ever finding out that even if mistakes are made, etc., the incentives are really running in the wrong direction.
As you go around the country and make these talks, what kind of reception are you getting?
Well, I think a lot of people are surprised at some of the issues and facts. For instance, when I say sneak and peek, that has such a pernicious sound to it.
Well, and tell us about it. What are the details?
Well, sneak and peek, I think it's a red herring. It's not really the issue. It was brought up, actually, during the presidential debate. But sneak and peek is a mechanism to go to a regular criminal court, a regular criminal judge, and ask for delayed notice of a search. So it might be 2 weeks, it might be 3 weeks, but it's not a perpetual secret thing. It's only a delayed notice so that the person who's the subject does not find out at that particular time. That actually might be more of a solution to what we could put into place in the war on terrorism. Temporary secrecy. But a judge has oversight of that, and they have to weigh and balance the need for the continued secrecy. Right now, with the FISA court, no judge weighs the need for continued secrecy. It's a given that it's perpetually secret. So that kind of a piece of information, most people, I think, are surprised to even... Or the other thing is that the most important item in the Patriot Act probably cannot sunset. That's another thing that surprises people.
Which item?
The FISA wall and the ability, you know, that what we do not have really right now any mechanism to prevent a potential abuse of the FISA court, which was what was behind the FISA wall anyways.
So that those transfers remain secret. The fact that the information has been transmitted, we'll never know that that's happened.
Yeah, I'll just say this is what I usually tell people. The number of searches, and this is not something secret, it's available on Electronic Privacy Information Center, the number of secret searches of computers and private residences and wiretaps and bugging that have occurred under the FISA law since 2001 have gone up from 920 in 2001 to 1,240-some in 2002 to 1,720-some in 2003. And so that's a very steep graph going up. The regular criminal authority and regular criminal drug cases and whatever, by comparison, all federal law enforcement agencies, it's a very rare technique, actually, is only between 500 and 600. And that's remained fairly constant since 1993.
So how many of those have resulted in any kind of action, prosecution?
Oh, almost all of them, because they're by the time they make it to court, what we call a Title III surveillance, by the time that would see a judge, it's usually at least a year or 2 years of investigation, and you end up with at least a 60 to sometimes even a 200-page affidavit detailing the probable cause and how all other law enforcement techniques have been exhausted. That's what you do in the criminal arena. You don't do that in the FISA arena. The FISA standard is quite a bit lower, or at least it's perceived to be lower. And again, what we're talking in numbers is now three times higher number in FISA searches or FISA applications as criminal applications.
Let's go to Newport News, Virginia. June is on the line. Hello,
hello.
June. Hi, do you have a question for us, June?
Yes, I do. I can hardly hear you, but Claire, would you do it again? Because I know people that have been whistleblowers, and they said they would just do the hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil because of how they were treated for bringing an honest situation to light.
Yes, I would do it again, and actually I've come close in a couple of other areas. In fact, I have the opposite viewpoint. I had a small role in some of the mistakes pre-9/11. I had a peripheral role in our office, and I witnessed what was developing, and I actually fault myself for not having taken stronger action in myself picking up the phone and calling headquarters. And having suffered through that and what resulted from that, I'm now of the mind that you should never sit back and think someone else will do the job and see or hear no evil. Despite the consequences.
Can I ask you one more question?
Yes.
The people I know were treated terribly for being honest. How have you been treated?
Well, I will say, and I'm going to give my hats off to the FBI in terms of professionalism, the people I worked with in the local Minneapolis division are just very professional. And even though there were times, I'm sure some of them did not agree with my views on things. By and large, I did not suffer the kind of retaliation where I, you know, couldn't do my job. It's tough because you know what people are thinking, and you know sometimes, but I actually think the FBI did a pretty good job. And Director Mueller, also part of it, my situation was that I got immediate media coverage and publicity. When that does not happen, it's a whole different story.
I realize when Senator Spector was talking to the agent and just said, we're going to keep an eye so she doesn't get any retaliation at those hearings. But I commend you because I was raised that when you see a wrongdoing, you speak up.
Thank you for your call, June.
Thank you.
And Colleen Raleigh, thank you very much. Colleen Raleigh retired on December 31st, 2004, after a 24-year career at the FBI. And she joined us from our studios in Minneapolis at Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul. Colleen, thanks very much.
Well, thank you for having me.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.